On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, Dr. Charles Richards teaches us the psychology of wealth. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Brian J. Bush. I'm joined today by Dr. Charles Richards, the author of The Psychology of Wealth. Dr. Richards, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
Your book makes some comparisons between brains and computers, and you also describe something that you call the family operating system. Could you tell us a bit about how that works in your experience?
Yeah, well, I make that comparison because I think it's a good analogy. When we grow up in a particular family, we get a certain download of sort of information just through osmosis from just being raised by, you know, our parents and adult caretakers. And that sort of download is what I call the family operating system. It basically governs our, you know, values, our thoughts about certain things, our likes, our dislikes. It also governs our attitudes and views and assumptions about money, finance, riches, the wealthy, et cetera, et cetera. And that family operating system is either functional or it's dysfunctional. And often with regard to money, and a lot of our experience, it's not as functional as it could be.
When you say it happens through osmosis, am I right in thinking that that means it's not necessarily a formal, hey, sit down, son or daughter, we're going to have a chat about how money works? It's more observing behavior, and it doesn't even have to be verbal sometimes?
Absolutely, absolutely. Parents often don't talk about money and finance and, you know, that whole issue with their kids, but the kids pick up these attitudes and thinking and assumptions, whether the parents speak about it consciously or not. And so that's what we basically operate from as we grow into young adults and adults.
Do you have any short anecdotes or stories of an example how that might work?
Whenever I'm working with a group or, you know, when I've talked with individuals during my counseling practice, I would constantly have clients describe to me how they had a certain thinking that they knew sort of handicapped them at a certain point of, let's say, financial success. They try to achieve a certain goal, or they'd reach a certain financial point in their life, and they seem to be stopped in their tracks. And they intuitively knew it was something in their thinking or some attitude or some fear, something they had picked up that was holding them back, and they wanted to resolve that. And, you know, generally it's something that developed from their parents.
Wow. Okay, I guess that's at least a little bit healthier than assuming it's, you know, the world conspiring against you.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is if we don't consciously examine that as we grow into adults and we try to reach certain goals and they constantly get frustrated and, you know, the person picks the other person to give the promotion to, or, you know, the favoritism goes in one direction or another, sometimes it can seem like, you know, the world is conspiring against us, but it's really our programming that's conspiring against us.
There's a story in the book I hadn't heard before about how a new sewing machine in the 1850s had a significant impact on American consumerism. What happened there?
Yeah, that's a great story. I'm glad you mentioned it because it really has to do with the Singer sewing machine, as a matter of fact. In fact, I was I'm in New York now, and I was walking down the street the other day, and I walked by a storefront, and they just had like hundreds of sort of classic Singer sewing machines in the window. I guess it was just part of their sort of persona for this particular store. But those Singer sewing machines reminded me of a time when families would basically purchase a Singer sewing machine on credit. And a lot of people today say all debt and credit's bad. Well, it depends on how you value and how you look at what the purchase is. I mean, back in those days, that Singer sewing machine would allow a woman to make a shirt that would normally take her 14 hours to sew, she could actually do it in 1 hour with that sewing machine. And basically the cost of buying a Singer sewing machine on credit was a dollar down, a dollar a week. And basically it was an incredible value for a family to get that machine because it saved so much time and energy and actually allowed that, you know, wife to, or woman in the house to really make more money than, far more money than the machine would cost her.
And I guess even at a dollar down, a dollar a week, that it worked out for the Singer company because they were around for a really long time.
Absolutely. It worked perfect. It was a symbiotic relation. It worked for the consumer and it worked for the company.
But then I guess over time, that one example and others like it sort of had a degrading effect on how people, well, and maybe degrading is just my own point of view, but it changed the way that people saw how they could be buying things. And we moved from a, you know, owning just what we needed culture to owning things we wanted.
But that evolved as a result of, you know, credit cards and revolving lines of credit, where basically we could make purchases by impulse, and we could just kind of buy without thinking, and we could continue to purchase without really coming to a cycle of completion, meaning to pay the debt off directly. I mean, we could just continue to spend and spend and spend, yeah, and pay a minimum amount on that balance. And of course, it's a never-ending balance. In fact, it sometimes is a continuously expanding balance. So before we know it, we're in serious debt. And I call that unconscious spending or unconscious debt.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that when people are purchasing with credit, they spend 300% as much as if they were using cash.
Yeah. And back in the day when credit was just getting popular, some of the, you know, corporate leaders of, you know, JCPenney and whatnot, it said that, you know, yeah, the average customer will spend 300 to 600% more over a year on credit than they do on cash.
So these days, the average family or household has, I guess, more house than they need, maybe nicer cars than they particularly need. We have multiple computers and multiple televisions in the house. Does that mean that we're doing it wrong? And if so, like, what is the cause, and what would you say would be a sensible way of maybe reversing it?
You know, I hate to make wrong and say people are doing it wrong, but it may mean we need to re-examine our values, because, you know, there's always going to be, you know, more and better modern technology. There's always going to be more things that are interesting to have. And the question is, do we feel like we have to have all of those things? At a certain point, we have to look at, okay, what do we really need? Mm. And based on that, you know, what are we going to spend our resources on? And if it's just accumulating more and more things, then often we find that we're just caught up in a situation that's going to leave us more insecure and unstable financially.
Yeah, if I were the same person that I was 3 years ago, I would be drooling over the iPad every hour of the day. But I don't have one, and I can't really think of a reason to get one because my computer does everything that it would do, except maybe be a really fancy cat toy. I don't have anything that could be a really fancy cat toy.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a great tool, but I was just talking to a friend the other day who said she was selling hers because in spite of how much she liked it, she really didn't use it. She used her primary laptop mostly. So yeah, you got a point there.
You mentioned something about values, and in the book there's a large section about people changing values, but first they need to find out what their core values are. Why is that important, and how can it be done?
Well, you kind of have to find out where you're starting before you can get to where you want to go. You have to find out where you are, and that has to do with really looking at your core values and determining if those core values are just hand-me-down values that you've unconsciously accepted from your family of origin, or if they're values that, based on your personal examination of your thinking and feeling and your attitudes and judgments, that you've really, what I call, upgraded to really reflect your true interests and what's really important to you. So you kind of have to start with your hand-me-downs and then determine, okay, you know, am I in harmony and in resonance with those? And if you aren't, then you have to start to think, okay, but what is it that I really believe and what do I really want to bring into my life?
Is that something that somebody would need to go to, say, a therapist for, or is it something they can do on their own? Because I'll be honest, I think about my childhood and I don't remember learning any lessons about money, but I'm sure I did through, you know, observing behaviors and things. But I can't jog my memory specifically to think about what it was I learned.
Yeah, you know, I don't think one has to necessarily go to a therapist to kind of get at this. It just takes spending some time and reflecting on, you know, specific aspects of you know, let's say if we're talking about money and finance, you know, what were your parents' attitudes about saving, about spending, about the rich, about various things that have to do with money and looking at, okay, is that functional or dysfunctional? Is that really serving me? You know, one thing that, you know, I when I'm talking to particularly adults, I talk about how your kids will do what you do, not necessarily what you say. So you can tell them, you know, do what I say, but basically what they get infused with is how you live your life. And that's what they start to reproduce when they get older. So you've got to really focus on what you're doing and determining, is that really optimal? And if it's not, you've got to make those adjustments or your kids will just do the same thing.
And one of the problems that adults have and they might pass on to their kids, however unwittingly, would be, you know, accumulating debt and just leaving it there and trying not to think about it or fix it. What sort of advice would you give to people with debt problems?
Well, you know, people with debt problems first need to really, okay, take stock of their situation and look at where they're at, you know.
I've heard from some people before that when they work with people who have lots of credit cards, they most of the time didn't even know what the total amount they owed was and were really shocked to find out what it was when, you know, a professional came in and looked at all the paperwork.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Often people have no idea. In fact, you know, we're often in denial about really being willing to look at, you know, where we stand financially. And it's something that we kind of sometimes have to just kind of screw up our courage to take a serious look at, because often we know intuitively that we're not going to like what we see, and then we're going to have to do something about it. And that's, again, another step that we need to come to terms with. Are you ready to make a change? And you have to first be ready to make a change before you can.
Remind me what it was in the book where you compared something to a car that was fishtailing on some slick roads.
Well, you know, it's there's a you know, popular kind of saying among some advocates that all debt is bad and that we should never use debt. And I think that's the reference you're referring to. And I like to communicate to people debt, you know, is like, you know, a kitchen knife. If you use it properly, it can be very useful and effective, but it needs to be tied to certain specific financial goals that are really going to serve you and your long-term future. And if you don't tie debt to that, then it's going to lead to unconscious spending and it's going to get you into financial trouble.
And I think that your book was one of the ones that was recommending sort of an all things in moderation approach where you can't, it's not realistic to drop absolutely everything and spend every penny you have on reducing your debt, because then you'll just have more reasons to be depressed and, you know, maybe get to a breaking point where you start charging things again.
Absolutely. I mean, there needs to be a balance. There need to be times when you reward yourself in ways that are practical for, you know, having a certain degree of restraint and self-discipline. But yeah, you don't want to be extreme in any way with regard to money and finance.
Tell me what you've learned over the years about how self-esteem influences wealth.
Well, you know, self-esteem is a tricky one because often self-esteem, particularly for males in our society, is tied to, your financial well-being. I was recently reading a statistic that women are starting to often earn more than their husbands, and it's sort of shifting sort of cultural values around, the significance of the primary breadwinner and that being the woman as opposed to a man. But often our self-esteem is tied to that, and we need to, I think, really unhook that, and that's sort of a slow process in our society, because we tend to, feel like if we're not making enough money, then our self-worth is low, or and really it has to do, in terms of our self-worth and self-esteem should be more related to the quality of our life, not the quantity of our bank balance book.
Can you think of any specific ways that a person could create that kind of self-esteem, if not, going out and getting a second job?
One thing I like to suggest to people, and it seems kind of counterintuitive if you're feeling sort of beat down and low self-esteem and feeling like you don't have enough, is find somebody or some situation that you can serve or give to. Because what often happens, almost always happens, is when you give to someone else or serve in some way, it opens the door to receiving. And so instead of sort of losing more of what you have, you actually open the doors to receiving more. And I've gotten numerous stories in my book of individuals who've actually found themselves by their willingness to extend themselves to other people.
How do you suppose that works on a practical level? Is it a reputation thing? Like, oh, I've got this thing that I want to do, and oh, I remember when this other person was really kind and generous to me, I should give them a call and see if they want to be a part of it?
Yeah, it could start anywhere. It could be philanthropic, it could be political, it could be religious or spiritual, or it could just be some, it could be an environmental cause, whatever it is that you feel passionate about or you feel you have value to contribute, you can move in that direction as sort of starting point.
Well, that's all fantastic information. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Charles Richards, the author of The Psychology of Wealth. Find more about the book and some videos at psychologyofwealth.org. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.